It's really important for Americans to understand that the decision to cut is a decision that is taken without even debating the alternative that's available, which is to tax the wealthy and the business community. And in case people are asking, gee, what about taxing them? Two little facts to remember. Over the last 30 or 40 years, the relative tax burden on corporations and the rich have dropped across the board in the United States dramatically. So all we would have to do to radically alter the picture is to bring taxes on wealthy people and the corporations back to where they were, not raise them above any historical level, just back to where they were, and the large part of the deficits at the local, state, and federal level would disappear.
Finally, we're seeing some activity on the case of Bradley Manning. You all remember Bradley Manning. He's sitting in some hellhole at Quantico, Virginia, under terrible conditions. He is the young soldier who allegedly turned over some of the material to WikiLeaks. Well, Bradley's been treated badly, and there's been very little attention paid to his case. I am happy to announce that a new advocacy fund has been launched. It's called the Bradley Manning Advocacy Fund.org.
It does not address the separate question of whether the killing of an individual within Yemen's territory is lawful. And the U.S. is really conflating those two questions to say that, you know, they have the authority both under the authorization for the use of military force, but also as a matter of self-defense to do what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that's what's so scary, that they are taking that authority and going around criminal law to execute somebody in Yemen.
Right. I mean, they're going around criminal law, they're going around international law, and claiming unreviewable authority to carry out global assassinations, which is really an escalation of what we saw under the Bush administration and what people found very alarming, which was global detention authority. Here we're talking about global killing authority, really. And whatever the allegations against this particular person, the point is that the authority could reach any U.S. citizen or any suspect that the United States deems to be a threat to, you know, its national security.
Could it reach someone in the United States?
Yeah, that was my question.
It could reach someone in the United States. The full contours of the government's argument would be that the decision to kill is for the executive to determine, and that should be an unreviewable decision, and that it's based on unknown criteria about involvement with terrorism or membership in al-Qaeda and associated groups. So there is no reason why it couldn't reach beyond Yemen to the United States or other countries.
All right. You guys have just come back from Arizona. You were working with the group No More Deaths. And I know you've shared some of your experiences with us prior to the show. But this is really an opportunity and a chance to tell us what happened. What did you see? I know you went on both sides of the border. Just start from why you were there and what you did.
Well, we were living in Patagonia, Arizona, which is near Nogales, Arizona. But the border actually runs right through Nogales. And so we were working on the Mexico side of Nogales, providing basic first aid to those deported who come on buses and are dropped off in Nogales on the Mexico side.
Nogales has a wall right dividing,
right?
Is that right?
That's right.
How high is that wall?
The wall is actually between 15 and 20 feet high, and it's this corrugated iron, corrugated tin wall that was actually built by the same company contracted that built the wall in Israel-Palestine.
I believe it's called Elbit Private Security.
So you see this wall, and it splits right down the middle of the city. So there's Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. And obviously, visually, the cities look completely different with crazy winding streets in Mexico and big, broad highways in Arizona. And you can look at this wall from any point of view, but from an environmental point of view, when the monsoons happen in Arizona, which happens for 2 months every year, the flooding comes down, comes from Mexico, and flows towards Arizona, towards the U.S., and gets stopped by the wall. So every year in monsoon season, 6 feet of water gather on the Mexico side, and there's these striking photographs that show both sides of the border, and there's nothing. There's a drought on the Arizona side.
One of the myths that has been propagated in American media is that this revolution or this uprising is entirely about internal domestic issues. Well, there were millions of people in Tahrir Square last Friday, Victory Friday as they called it, and one of their demands was reopening the Rafah crossing. When we were in Cairo for the Gaza Freedom March, our goal was to get through Rafah into Gaza. And we didn't succeed in that because of the Egyptian regime's complicity with the Israeli and American blockade and siege of Gaza. So Rafah is supposed to be open now.
Can you give a few examples of what kinds of actions have taken place?
Yeah. So one great example of a direct action we did, well, we've done it twice. We've done two tree sits. And the first one was on the edge of the Ed White permit site, which is in the Coal River Valley. And the second one is also in the valley, and it was on Coal River Mountain. And during the first tree sit, they held ground for about 5 days. During the second, two of the tree sitters were in the trees for 9 days, stopping blasting on their respective parts of the site that they were sitting in.
Now, what happens to the people? They get arrested? What are the courts down there like? Are people in jail for this stuff?
It's widely uneven. So we've had everything from people getting, you know, bond options of $250, $350 to, after an action blocking the road to Massey Regional Headquarters in Boone, West Virginia, in May, two activists were given $100,000 bails. And so there's this sort of like wildly uneven thing with the setting of bails and bonds. Those bails were eventually brought down. The case went to circuit court, and the circuit court judge in Boone dropped it down to $2,500 with a $2,500 bond option, $25,000 bail. And then in terms of sentencing, that's also been widely uneven. We've seen people with comparable charges getting everything from $100 fines to 60 days in jail without a way to appeal that.
If people want to know more information and or want to consider contributing or giving to the bail fund, et cetera, where do they go? You have a website?
Our website is climategroundzero.org, and people can go on that site and they can check out our actions and they can donate, learn more about what we're doing, and we have links on that site to learn more about mountaintop removal.
This is a pivotal time in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we understand that you have rushed, actually, to finish Justice on Trial in order to have it screened in Philadelphia with Tiger Hill's competing film. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. When we started working on this film a few years ago, I tried very hard to get interviews with the widow of the police officer who was killed on the night of December 9th. And I was looking all over to be able to interview her. I think it's important to sort of, for the film, to be able to show the impetus and the values of the other side of the story, to show what it is that drives that side. And I wanted to get that part of the story. And in doing that, I sort of realized, and I met Tiger Hill, in that process realized that they already had their man. They already had someone who was making a film from their perspective. And in that process, I came to understand Tiger Hill is making a film that's sort of basically a propaganda for the other side. And we've known about each other for the past couple of years, and I realized that the film is going to be made. It's going to have to be a film about the Mumia part of the story, and it's going to be another film about the police side, basically. We knew about that, and then finally, Tiger came out, and we saw his trailers for his film and realized that it's going to be a very unfair and propagandistic film of the other side. It's not in any way trying to show what the case is and what it means, what does it say about the larger political picture in this country. It's a film basically arguing the prosecution side.
Are animal rights activists terrorists? The FBI seems to think so, as it's labeled them one of the top domestic terrorist threats in this country. We'll hear excerpts from a panel held at the 2009 Animal Rights Conference in Los Angeles last month. We'll now hear from award-winning writer Will Potter, who also runs the website greenisthenewred.com.
So flash forward a little bit. There are these arrests in California of people that done nothing more than, at worst, using their First Amendment activity and their First Amendment rights in a controversial way of protesting outside someone's home. They're accused, among other things, of chalking defamatory slogans on the public sidewalk using children's sidewalk chalk. The second group of arrests were two individuals in Utah, and they are a little bit more in line of what members of Congress said this law is all about. William Veal, or BJ, and Alex Hall, they're both in their early 20s. They were arrested on March 5th, 2009, and accused with participating in an August 2008 Animal Liberation Front fur farm raid in Utah. The raid released about 300 mink, caused about $10,000 in damage, according to the government. At the site of the raid were a spray painting that read, "No more mink, no more murder," and "ALF, we are watching." So you might be thinking, well, what is the constitutional argument to make about that? It's clearly not First Amendment activity. And that's not my task up here tonight. I'm not arguing in any way that it's First Amendment activity. But at the end of the day, what this case, I think, illustrates perhaps most clearly of the government's continued war on the animal rights and environmental movements is the stark contrast between what is being labeled, according to the FBI, as the number one domestic terrorism threat and what most reasonable people would consider terrorism. And that's this: one is intended to destroy life and the other is intended to protect it. Together, the arrests in Utah and in California, in my mind, truly reflect both the breadth and the depth of the government's continued war on dissent. They illustrate the true motives, the scope, and the willingness and the lengths to which they're willing to go to enforce this corporate political agenda. It doesn't end there, though. The depth that we're talking about is actually quite a bit deeper than that. And we need to keep in mind through all of this that the government and corporations have tried to have a monopoly on the terrorism rhetoric in the entire cycle, linear process of these cases. So before activists are arrested as terrorists, as they're just going about their business, they're smeared as eco-terrorists and domestic terrorists. Their media campaigns, their sound bites, their speeches, they're routinely harassed by FBI and by law enforcement. They're harassed in the press by corporations, and that's these outlandish press campaigns calling them terrorists for trying to speak out on behalf of animals. When they are arrested, either they're hit outright with terrorism charges, as in these cases, or after they're convicted, they're hit with terrorism enhancement penalties, as was the case in the Operation Backfire cases out in the Pacific Northwest. Then, after they're convicted, they have that terrorism label follow them throughout the rest of their criminal justice experience, let's call it that. So activists have black boxes around their wrists as they're transported between facilities. They often have orange jumpsuits to designate them as terrorist inmates. They have their privileges restricted. And what we're seeing now is a continued extension of that with what are called communication management units. Thank you.
Michael, there's been zillions of words and articles about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and of course in this country he's looked at as a pariah, despite the fact that, of course, that every newspaper in the country is covering what he has done, and he's obviously made a major contribution to our understanding of how our government runs. But give us a second on your political take on what you think of WikiLeaks.
You know why I like him? I like him for the same reason I liked it when the Russian revolutionaries opened the books and all the czar's secret diplomacy, and they showed how First World War was an imperialist war, and it showed the secret deals between France and England and the Russian Tsar on how to divide up the Ottoman Empire once they won the first great war of the 20th century, the first great imperial slaughter. They wanted to divide up the Ottoman Empire. And in 1916, they had a treaty called the Sykes-Picot Treaty, where they whacked up all this rich Ottoman stuff between France and England.
But even then, Michael, let's just say, it wasn't just rich Ottoman stuff, it was oil. Because what was happening is the ships were turning from coal, where they needed fueling stations all over, to oil burning. And they recognized that. And so when the First World War, during it actually, they were going to divide up the oil in the Middle East.
Oil. You remember when they stupidly called the war against Iraq Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL, and they realized they made a dumb mistake and they changed it? It's still about oil.
So let's put it into perspective. So you're saying the First World War is really about imperialist overreach. The second example we have is, of course, the Pentagon Papers.
Uh-huh. Same thing.
Same thing. Again, about showing the lies about the war, supposedly to, you know, whatever, help the Vietnamese people, whatever, BS, stop communism. But, of course, it was, in fact, about the U.S. in the Far East and its role in the Far East and what Ellsberg was able to do. Now let's compare it here. What have we seen in these documents, the wiki, that makes you also see that really what he has exposed here is imperial overreach?
Well, he's shown the nature of these governments that the United States installed and props up in both oil-rich Iraq, carbon-rich Afghanistan. And that's what's horrifying people like Hillary Clinton. The secrets are coming out, the nature of these governments, how they talk to each other. WikiLeaks provided a service. They opened the books on America's secret dealings the same way the Russian revolutionaries opened the books up in 1917. That's what's driving these people crazy. They're threatening not just to prosecute them for espionage. That's the soft line. The right-wing commentators on Fox News and people like Sarah Palin are calling for his death.